University of California Television presents this podcast of Conversations with History, featuring Robert O. Cohane discussing theory and international institutions, recorded in March 2004. UCTV's Conversations with History series is hosted by Harry Kreisler, director of UC Berkeley's Institute of International Studies. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Robert O. Cohane, who is the James B. Duke Professor of Political Science at Duke University and one of the most distinguished theorists of international relations. He has also taught at Swarthmore College, Stanford, Brandeis, and Harvard. His publications include After Hegemony, International Institutions and State Power, Power and Governance in a Partially Globalized World, Ideas and Foreign Policy, co-edited with Judith Goldstein, and Power and Interdependence, co-authored with Joseph S. Nye, Jr. Bob, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born and raised in Chicago and then in Western Illinois, but my parents met right here at Berkeley.
And how was that? Were they students here?
They were master students here in history and political science, and they met in the library.
Uh-huh. Did you visit the library on this visit?
Not this time. Yeah. I wasn't open, but I visited last visit. I did. I have made my pilgrimage to the library. Apparently, my father hung around, followed my mother home, found out where she was living, hung around for a couple days, and on their first date, invited her. Asked her to marry him, which was impetuous, as he always was.
And little did they know that that meeting would lead to so many studies in international relations.
Right. Well, let's hope it wouldn't have reversed the
So whole looking
process.
Back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Well, they were both social scientists. My dad taught at Chicago in the college, and then later at a place called Scheimer College. So he was a student of history. He had never finished his PhD thesis, which was on the Third International. So he had this active interest in politics, and he was also an amateur politician. He was the Fifth Ward Chairman of the IBI, the Independent Voters of Illinois, in Chicago in 1949-50. So they were very active in the anti-communist, social democratic part of the Democratic Party in the period that I was growing up. I was born in 1941. And my mother was a socialist in the 1930s. She was the daughter of a missionary. She was born in Japan. And she became a very active leader of the League of Women Voters and other organizations. And she also taught high school at Phillips High School in Chicago, which was in the middle of the ghetto at the time. And it was an all-black high school. So I was raised with a very strong sense of social responsibility, a very active sense of politics. We talked about politics a lot. I remember the Alger Hiss case vividly as they struggled with Alger Hiss's guilt, which they recognized quite early, but most of their friends didn't.
Mm-hmm. And so was it inevitable that you would go into political science and government, the study of government, or was that just a choice you made, and when did you make it?
Well, I considered law, like people often do.
Like everybody does.
Yes, yeah. Right. I considered journalism. I remember when I had my interview for the Woodrow Wilson Fellowships, I said maybe teaching, maybe law, maybe journalism. My mother had always thought I should go and become a city manager because, yeah, she had this good government orientation. But I think I was too much of an intellectual for that. I'm not sure it was inevitable, but it was pretty well channeled, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was very rebellious about this.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
A place called Scheimer College, which was an offshoot of Chicago. I was an early entrant, so I entered when I was not quite 16. Robert Maynard Hutchins had set up the college in Chicago in the 1940s. My dad taught there. And in 1950, they felt Chicago was getting a little bit rough for 16-year-olds, so they didn't acquire this place called Scheimer College. It was a two-year women's college that was on the ropes. But they transplanted the Chicago program to it. And my dad went out there, actually, to transplant the social science part of the program, and he stayed. So I lived there until I was through the second year of high school, and then I fled to Scheimer. So I was there from the time I was 16 to the time I was 19. Mm-hmm.
And then you went on to do graduate work at Harvard?
That's right.
Yeah. And what do you remember from your days at Harvard? Who were your mentors there?
The chair of my dissertation committee was Stanley Hoffman, and he's the person I'm most indebted to, although my strongest intellectual mentor was probably Judith Sklar, the political theorist, mm-hmm. who was, I think, the most powerful mind in the department, even though at the time she was a lecturer because she was discriminated against on the basis of being a woman. And she was someone who was quite fearsome, because if you didn't get it right, you would know it from her. So Hoffman and Sklar, who actually were close, very, very close friends themselves, are my two chief mentors from Harvard.
So you were you dabbling at first in just regular political theory?
I was always interested in political theory. I'm a theorist by nature, and I love political theory more than anything else. I think if I hadn't had this social democratic do good, very strong impression from my mother, who was a huge influence on me, I might have become a political theorist, political philosopher. It just wasn't practical enough for me at that time. I wanted to actually accomplish something in the world a little bit more than the study of Locke and Hobbes mm-hmm. suggested. So that's, I think, why I became a theorist of international relations, because I'm a theorist at heart. It's what I enjoy most. And yet international relations was something that appeared to be more practical and have more impact on the world. And this was, of course, 1961 when I left college, which was the year Kennedy's inauguration speech, and the sense that the communism was taking over the country,
over the world,
and that somehow we had to devise better ways to defend American values and democracy and freedom in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, help us understand what a theorist of international relations does. What is the nature of the subject matter, and how does that constrain the things that you can do?
I think it's first important to recognize that you can't understand the world without some theory of it, even though it may be implicit, because it's so complicated, there's so much happening, that you have to order these events somehow. So even if you think you're not a theorist, you have some implicit theory. Maybe it's a crude theory of power politics, or maybe it's a moralistic theory. But there's some theory behind people's interpretation of the world. So the first thing we try to do is make that explicit, because if it's implicit, it may be inconsistent or maybe just simply not plausible once it's explicated in the light of day. So then, if one makes it explicit, then one sees that there are certain things that are puzzling. That is, certain things don't fit. The world keeps changing. And the interesting things for theorists are where there is some disjunction between what our theories tell us ought to be the case, what we ought to be seeing, and what we actually are seeing. And that kind of disjunction is what one tries to rectify. Say, how could we change the theory or elaborate a new theory in a way that would help us to understand this anomaly, this puzzle?
And it's a hard subject matter in the sense that it's hard to do scientific prediction, isn't it? I mean, it's not as easy as dealing with rocks or atoms, right?
I'm not sure dealing with rocks and atoms is easy, but yeah. Having not done it, but it's certainly, I don't believe we can do prediction very well, and I think we can't do prediction very well because the theory becomes part of the background knowledge of the actor, and so in strategic interaction, if you are, if I know what your strategy is, I can devise a strategy which will beat it. But then if you know what my strategy is, you can change your strategy. Mm-hmm. So there's the old kids game of rock, scissors, paper, I often analogy. There's no solution to that game. Mm-hmm. There's no best strategy, because if you know I'm going to play rock, scissors, alternate, you can beat me every time. Mm-hmm. So I have to change my strategy. Then you have to change your strategy. So I don't think we can seek prediction in this realm. When we're talking about a relatively small number of actors, normally states or multinational firms or NGOs, acting strategically with one another in a situation where they're competitive. So I don't aspire to prediction. I think you have to look for the understanding of the underlying dynamics and structures that are shaping and constraining the actors.
Help me understand what it takes to do this kind of work. I mean, what kind of temperament, what kind of training to do this well?
Can I give you an example first?
Yes.
Example from my own work, just to give you a sense and give the audience a sense of what this is like. When I was in my 30s, the dominant view of international relations was called realism. Mm-hmm. And that is the view that basically state power and state interests determine the constraints under which world politics operates. International institutions are not very important. And it's a realm of anarchy and conflict. So essentially, this view was very good at explaining the fact that we have lots of conflict in world politics, and that the conflict takes place over interests, that states which are more powerful get their way over those that are less powerful. And so there's a lot of behavior it explains. But in the 1970s, when I was looking at this, there was also, as there is now, lots of institutionalized cooperation. And in fact, the European Union was much stronger than anybody had thought it would be. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade were all quite extensively institutionalized and cooperative. And if the theory had been right, these wouldn't have existed, and they wouldn't have lasted. So that was the puzzle. That was the anomaly. And then one has to figure out, how, given the constraints of what we know about world politics, could these arrangements last? Well, it can't be the case that these international organizations are set up above states, that there's some running things, because we know the states are more powerful. Mm-hmm. So somehow the states had a motivation to establish international institutions that would constrain themselves with rules. Well, why would they do that? Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of puzzle I approached. And the general answer to the puzzle is you accept constraints on yourself because in certain domains like trade, it's more important that others constrain, to have their tariffs limited. So you agree to bind your tariffs, so they will agree to bind their tariffs. That makes uncertainty less, allows for investment, allows for trade, and therefore produces a joint gain. So it's not the case that you always have cooperation, but where you have the potential for joint gain, you have an incentive to construct institutions that will allow you to capture that potential for joint gain. So that's kind of an example of the sort of puzzle-solving mentality that a theorist has. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you need one point about temperament. One needs a relatively long time horizon. I won't say patient. I'm not a patient person. But you have to be willing to work at a problem for a while and not expect to have instant gratification of it. So that's certainly the case. You have to be interested in puzzles for their own sake, because you are trying to resolve an anomaly or a puzzle. You don't know what the practical result of that will be, even though this was motivated by the practical concern of increasing cooperation. So there may be a motivation, in my case there was, to eventually improve the way people behave in world politics by making them more cooperative, because they could see how they could cooperate when they might previously have thought they had to conflict with each other and had to fight. So there is a moral motivation behind it, but you have to have a kind of long-term horizon about figuring out the puzzle and expecting that sooner or later it's going to come back into the practical world. But for a while, you're quite happy to be outside of that world.
It sounds like it also takes courage and determination, in the sense that you're saying, hey, the conventional wisdom is that realism explains just about everything, and it's all we need to know. And as a leader and in defining political economy as a subject area, you're really going against what I guess we would call the conventional wisdom in the field. Is that correct?
Well, certainly you have to like attacking the conventional wisdom. Yes, you have to you have to have that element, not really being a rebel, but you have to have that element of liking to go after the dominant view. And it's like big game hunting in a way. You're not just going around shooting jackrabbits or something. You're actually trying to land big game, and so you're taking more chance. I'm not sure I would say courage, but certainly determination, mm-hmm. and a willingness to take some risks and mm-hmm. say, maybe people think I'm a fool for years and years, but I'm going to take this line and try to build this argument in various ramifications. Now, you mentioned political economy. In fact, the work I was talking to you about a minute ago about cooperation comes from the 1980s, although I started working on it in the late 70s. The earlier trend with Joe Nye was to contravene the notion that world politics is only about security affairs, and that political economy is not an important part of it. When we started this work in 1970, people were ignoring multinational enterprises. They were looking at only at the state system. They considered the economic relations among the advanced countries to be low politics, not very interesting. Mm-hmm. What was interesting was the U.S.-Soviet conflict, nuclear weapons, international crises. And our view was that that was also interesting, but there was a whole phenomenon which was certainly increasingly important. Of political economy, of the use of politics to shape the economy, of the use of economic wealth to shape politics, which was not being studied. So that was another dimension of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you grappled with this set of problems in international organization, where did you look for theories in other disciplines that might be helpful to you? Because I think part of what you were doing was applying theories that came out of industrial organization and market failure to help you understand the world that you were grappling with. Talk a little about that. I mean, what sort of intellectual exchanges led you in that direction?
Well, I was a great beneficiary of a number of friends who knew more about this than I did and students. And it goes back to my time at Swarthmore College because a very good friend of mine named Van Ooms was an economist there. And we taught a course together on multinational corporations. In a big university, an economist wouldn't have taught a course with a young political scientist and nothing about this. And I learned a lot in that course, both about how economists think, but also about the subject. Even though I was supposedly teaching it, you learn something best, of course, when you're teaching it. So I had this active interest in political economy and knew something. I won't say I knew a lot of economics, but I knew some descriptive economics. And then when I got interested in the question of cooperation, or even early in that phase, I had a student named Timothy McCune, who is now at North Carolina as a professor, and he was a student also of Jim March. Tim kept coming to me with these arguments from industrial organization theory, which were coming out of some of March's work. And so, as is often the case, you learn as much from your students as your students learn from you. Mm-hmm. I started reading some of this material. I remember Laura Tyson was at Stanford then as a postdoctoral fellow before she became famous, and I went and had lunch with her and talked about Oliver Williamson's work, which I'd never heard of. And she said, you ought to read Williamson, who is a student of industrial organization, who studies many things that are analogous to international politics, though he's not studying international. He's studying monopoly and competition and the relationship between them. I had a cognizant dean, the dean who was the dean for our department, a man named Jim Ross, an economist, who gave me his syllabus on international organization, which in the pre-internet days was handy, a packet like this of Xerox materials. And I remember reading Paul Samuelson's article on monopolistic competition and thinking, wow, this is like international politics. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that, of the insight then came out of really analogies with work by economists. And the most important piece of work was by an economist at Berkeley named George Akerlof, who later, much later, won the Nobel Prize for this article partly called The Market for Lemons. Because Akerlof showed how in an economic market, the used car market, there could be market failure. That is, the lack of institutions could create a situation where prices didn't clear. A buyer was not able to buy a car from a seller for a mutually agreed price, which would have been good for them both. Mm-hmm. Because there were no institutions, there was no ability to make credible promises unless you had this institution of the used car dealer. And I saw immediately that the used car dealer was very much like the international institution, mm-hmm. who would increase the credibility of promises, reduce uncertainty, reduce the cost of transactions, and therefore this was the key to thinking about what was the role of international institutions. They were like the used car dealer, ironically enough, because they really made it possible for these otherwise separate and distrustful entities, the buyer and the seller or the two countries, to actually make a deal which they would both benefit from, even though they were in some sense in a partially adversarial situation.
And so how then did you, what in applying this these kinds of theories to what was going on in international relations that was not being explained by the state-centric model, what specific subject areas did you look at, and then what conclusions did you reap? What made cooperation work? The very same kind of factors that were described in these theories?
Well, I was looking at post-war patterns of cooperation in political economy between the United States and Western Europe, especially also Japan later. So I was looking at trade, at oil, at monetary relationships, at the political economy of the period from 1945 until 1980 or so. That was the domain for the analysis. I was trying to understand why there was so much cooperation, and also why it wasn't totally general, why there was variation in cooperation. I want to say two more things about this. One is that, to go back to your earlier question about determination and courage, I don't know if it's that, but you've got to be willing to be very dissatisfied for a substantial period of time if you want to attack big theory problems. I remember vividly, I was at Stanford until 1981, and I published this book in 1984, and I really figured it out by about 82, most of it, or at least the essence of it. But I remember for a couple of years, probably 1979 to 81, I didn't want to go to a cocktail party. I didn't want someone to ask me, what are you working on? I couldn't say three coherent sentences about it. I was so confused about it. And I think that it's important to recognize that confusion is a necessary condition for really doing significant work, I won't say major, but making some step forward. Because if the problem isn't really confusing, it's not that difficult a problem, and you can sort of figure it out right away. So you have to allow yourself to be confused, and it's a very difficult situation to be in. It makes you unhappy to be confused all the time, and to try to figure out, why can't I figure this out properly? My mentor, Judith Sklar, said to me after I went to Brandeis in 1982, I was having lunch with her and talking to her very tenderly about this book on cooperation I wanted to write, and she said, oh, will it be a small book with large type and large margins? That is, there's nothing to say about this in international politics. My admired, powerful mentor said this, so what are you doing it for, in effect? Well, that's a real challenge, right? But you have to, and maybe that is courage. Maybe you have to say, okay, I'm going to do it anyway, even though this person I admire more than anybody else in the world intellectually thinks it's an impossible task, which is foolish, because I know that if I could do it, then it couldn't be belittled. It would have to be an accomplishment if she thinks it's impossible for it to happen. Now, the second thing I wanted to say is that a lot of academics benefit tremendously from giving talks on work that is in progress. You may think you're doing somebody a favor to go and give a talk for them, and you don't get paid for it, you just go. But you learn a tremendous amount from it. And one of the puzzles was broken in a talk I gave in Washington at Fred Bergson's Institute. Fred Bergson is the policy-oriented economist, probably the most important policy-oriented person in the last 20 years working on issues of political economy, but he's not a theorist. But I gave this talk, and it was about cooperation, and Fred said right away, well, what's the difference between cooperation and harmony? And I realized that was the key to the puzzle. That is, I wasn't going to argue that there was harmony. There's not harmony. There's conflict in international politics. It's a decentralized realm. It's anarchy in a certain sense. So cooperation has to be something different, and it comes out of conflict. It's mutual adjustment to conflict. And once you could see cooperation that way, not as harmony, which made it sort of seem odd, how would you ever get cooperation to fit in international politics if it's harmony? Once you see that it's actually a form of discord which generates cooperation, mutual adjustment instead of conflict, then you can get a handle on it, because it becomes very similar to the problem of conflict. It's the obverse side of conflict. But that wouldn't have come to me, perhaps, if Fred hadn't just said it at that talk, and I wouldn't have heard that if I hadn't been giving that talk.
So help us understand by talking about one of the topics that you focused on, one of these issue areas, and how, try to recall a creative moment where you saw something in one of these issue areas that really helped you gather momentum on this journey that you were taking.
You know, you asked earlier what it's like to be a theorist, and I think the answer is it goes the other way. Mm-hmm. That is, the creative moments I remember especially are reading Samuelson, reading Akerlof, hearing Bergson ask about cooperation and harmony. They're conceptual moments. Mm-hmm. So when you conceptualize the problem differently. So I already had a description in my, I knew what had happened in trade policy. I knew that there had been an expansion of cooperation, take trade. In 1930, the U.S. passed a very high tariff, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which basically had a 50% plus tariffs across most American products. And by 1975, when I was working on this, the tariff was down to about 7 or 8%. Now it's below 5%. Dramatic fall in tariffs, which had not been forecast by people earlier. So here's a huge fall in tariff, which results from cooperation, results from a set of rules, the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, which are gradually instituted and gradually made more binding, even though they weren't very strong legally. And so the question is, well, how did that happen? What was contributed there? Well, what was happening there, it appeared to me, was that when you observed it, you saw a pattern of reciprocity. Nobody was being altruistic. Nobody was giving away. Nobody was doing what the economists said either, which said, lower your tariffs, it's for your own good. They weren't doing that. They were saying, I'll lower my tariff on sheep's blood if you'll lower your tariffs on cow dung, that kind of thing. Right? It just to take non-examples, or in real terms, I'll lower my tariff on pasta if you'll lower your tariff on wine and textile machinery. And so it was a pattern of reciprocity, but then how did they make that stick? They made it stick by making a set of deals and institutionalizing them in rules, which they then had an obligation to maintain, and a pattern of domestic politics was then generated, which supported those rules, because export industries became stronger over time and import competing industries became weaker over time. So it's this complex pattern that you observed, which was institutionalized cooperation driven by a desire to cooperate because actors saw they could gain from it, not altruistically, then leading to lower tariffs, then leading to a different composition of the domestic political economy with more export firms who supported even lower tariffs. The import competing firms that were losers were weakened because the tariffs were lower and they were driven out of business, and you had this spiral. So that was, I understood the spiral, but the question is, well, what is really, what contribution is being made by the international institution? And that really is the reduction of uncertainty, the creation of a situation where the costs of making deals are lower because you have regular trade rounds, and the increased credibility of promises because the cost of breaking rules is higher than the cost of breaking one promise. And so if the promises were institutionalized in a set of rules, and you either on the whole kept the promises or you threatened the whole institution, which was benefiting yourself, the tendency was to, in the long run, not always right away, to grudgingly keep your promises, as the U.S. did 2 months ago on steel tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Now, another element in this evolution of ideas in the field was really a journal like International Organization, which you were editor of. And help us understand how that really contributes to the process of building the space of ideas.
Well, this is a journal, like many journals, which is double-blind refereed, people understand that. That is, academics send in their manuscripts, and two referees, or sometimes three, read them. And the referees don't know who wrote the paper, and the paper writer never knows who the referees were. So it's as objective a process as you can get. Of course, people's ideas are not totally objective, but and I took over International Organization as editor in 1974, when I was 32, because the then editor had left his university suddenly. And I was on the board of the journal, and I was prevailed upon to take it over temporarily, and then I enjoyed doing it and thought it was fun, and did it for 6 years. What the journal does, if it's a major journal as International Organization is, it's a focal point for people's attention to the field. And if there's something changing in the field, something going on, it's a way to transmit this information quickly to people and to make it common knowledge so everybody will have read the recent issues of International Organization and will be able to talk about them. Joe Nye and I had put out our first work on so-called transnational relations, the role of non-state actors, multinational corporations in world politics, in a special issue of I.O., as we call it, I.O., before I was editor. And right after I was editor, there was a special issue which Fred Bergston was involved in, and also Joe Nye and Lawrence Krauss on political economy, which kind of put political economy on the agenda. It says, here is a major statement half the articles by economists, half by political scientists, some of them jointly by political scientists and economists, on the major issues of political economy today: multinational investment, trade, international monetary system, and the institutional and political factors that are affecting them. So you can do that with a journal, and everybody could see it, and it was also published as a book, but the journal part was probably more significant. And the advantage of being a journal editor is that you're at the center of this process. You see it and you can shape it to some extent. My first issue, I wrote an essay, an editor's essay, called International Organization, the journal's title, and the Crisis of Interdependence, where I made a claim, and this was in 1974, right, or 1975, probably right after the oil crisis, that there was a crisis going on of interdependence. The growth had slowed down or stopped in the West. There was a general sense that we had to restructure the system after Bretton Woods had collapsed. And so it was a moment when it was clear that people needed to think politically about the world economy, because it wasn't automatically taking care of itself. And I was in the right place in the right time.
Mm-hmm. And did you said in when we were talking about your background that your parents had focused you a lot on sort of what was going on in the world, and yeah. and was this an outlet for that sensitivity that they must have generated, because a lot was going on in the world as you were doing this work about that made one wonder about where this interdependence and later globalization would be going.
Well, I think I got two senses from my parents there. One was a very strong sense of moral commitment. I've always been a student of international politics because I cared about the outcomes, not just for curiosity. I thought, maybe with hubris, that one could make some difference in how people behave in the world if they think differently about it. And if they have the notion that they have to conflict, they can generate policies such as those of the second Bush administration, which generate more conflict. And if they have the idea that somehow if they redesigned their policies or institutions, there could be more mutually beneficial collaboration without giving up one's own interests, the world would be a better place. That was, in a sense, one of the driving forces. That comes from my mother's strong sense of social democracy and the missionary child who has left her religion, her Orthodox religion, but who retains the secular mission of the missionary to make the world better. And that was definitely transmitted to me. And the other side of it is the interest in the world. Well, there's really three sides of it. The second side is, as you say, interest in the world. It was always what was changing in the world was always a topic of conversation in our household. So I was always well aware this was a fascinating world, that things happened. You didn't know what was going to happen. And the third element, which I think came from my dad, was much more the theorist element. My mother was more practical and more oriented toward action. My father was more oriented toward reading and reflection. Though they both did some of both. And I think that the theoretical side probably comes from him, the willingness to sit back in the study for a couple of years and try to think about a problem, as opposed to going out and serving as a undersecretary of something.
Mm-hmm. How was what you were doing affected by what I will call the clash of schools, not of civilization, but the clash of schools, namely that from this work, your work and the work of others, a subfield can be said to have emerged in international relations theory, political economy, international institutions, and so on. But the realist theory, the state-centric model, was still there, and in some ways still on the attack. How was your work furthered by that dialogue within the discipline from people who weren't part of this community that you were building or were part of building?
I'm greatly in debt to Kenneth Waltz, whom you've interviewed, and who was involved in a seminar that you and I were both involved in the seminars in the 70s at Berkeley. We met maybe five times a term, a seminar on international movements and national control. Because Ken, the most distinguished realist thinker of his generation, was in the process of systematizing a realist view that had been brilliantly developed by Hans Morgenthau and E.H. Carr and George Kennan and others, but never really systematized in a way that was rigorously logical. And Waltz did that in a book published in 1979, but most of this had been published in an article published in 1975. So in the period of the mid-70s, when I was at Stanford and he was at Berkeley, he was doing this. And that was clearly a powerful intellectual construction. And it had, first place, it meant that the realist view was a lot clearer than it had been. So you could see what it was and what its integrity was. And secondly, therefore, it seemed to me that it made it clearer what it was missing. It was missing any attention to information, to the variation in how much information people have and how much uncertainty there is. That was ignored in the theory. And the very clarity of the theory and the very explicitness and intellectual power of it, as Waltz expressed it in a book of less than 200 pages, showed you where the weak points were. It was as if he was showing you a blueprint, and here there was the weak point. No concern with uncertainty, information, and therefore the role of institutions was omitted. Well, once I realized that institutions serve principally to reduce uncertainty and provide information and credibility, then it was clear how the institutions fit into the missing part of Waltz's theory. So it's terribly important to have somebody who has a rebel against orthodoxy, always in the debt, greatly in the debt, of the people who can express what is the dominant view with utter clarity and logic.
Mm-hmm. Now, give us an example of what those terms mean when you think about, you know, information, uncertainty, and so on, by giving us a concrete example. Okay. in a particular issue area, the kind of matter that people care about that Waltz wasn't addressing.
Let's go back to trade. Mm-hmm. Trade is a classic case where there's a conflict, because if we have two states, both of which are under the influence of their manufacturers, and therefore they want to export, but they also want to limit imports, this leads to conflict, because if everybody can't both export and not import. Mm-hmm. So there's some, and there is and has been known for almost 200 years, there is a joint gain to be made if they can both liberalize. Overall, they will both benefit, but there will be losers. The weaker manufacturers who are now hiding behind tariff walls in their own countries will lose, because they'll lose those markets and they may go out of business. So the problem is, how do you overcome this? Now, if you simply had no institutions, the problem is clearly that if you can make promises to each other, but then what do I do? Do I accept your promise and therefore cut my tariffs and hope that you will, in fact, not only reduce your tariffs, but you'll also not do other things surreptitiously, which I can't observe always, to equivalently have a tariff, like a subsidy to these firms. So, and if I can't accept your promise, I can't persuade anybody on my side to lower our tariffs, so nobody lowers tariffs. So somehow, how do you reduce that uncertainty? Well, one way you reduce it is to say, we'll both commit to a set of rules, and these rules are general across a lot of products, so that if you start breaking the rules on one set of products, there's a danger you'll bring the whole system down. And then those industries in your country, which are exporters and are worried about that, all of a sudden become worried that if you're violating the rules on textiles and shoes, maybe this will cost them access for televisions and jet aircraft. Mm-hmm. And then they are mobilized on you. So but the key to start that process is to institutionalize a set of rules that reduces the uncertainty that you actually will keep your promise, and therefore increases the credibility of your promise.
And this would be done through an organization such as the World Trade Organization.
Such as the World Trade Organization, right.
Now the next problem that then comes up, once you put something like that in place, is really the whole problem of democratic accountability. I mean, who is the WTO responsible? Now, as a theorist, the lights must turn on in your brain because it raises a whole new set of problems.
It raises a whole, and I've been working on accountability recently. Mm-hmm. Earlier, I was working on what are the functions performed by all these organizations, and now the question arises, as you say, as they become stronger, and WTO has become quite strong. What about democratic accountability, or what about any kind of accountability? The first point to recognize is there are other kinds of accountability that aren't simply democratic accountability. That is, it's a kind of pluralist accountability. There's the accountability to a set of laws. There's accountability of the states to a judicial system in the World Trade Organization. There is reputational accountability. States may worry about their reputations. I don't think it's possible at the current stage of world politics to expect highly developed democratic accountability. We don't have a world government. We're not going to have a world government for a while. There's not enough consensus and not enough sense of common interest and common values. So we're going to have to settle for more fragmented forms of accountability, and it's going to be a trade-off, because there's some trade-off between local control, of course, and having this kind of international cooperation.
You and this subfield of political economy were really positioned to help us understand globalization in a way that the state-centric model did not. Talk a little about that. In other words, so this work really, in a way, positioned the field to be able to think about those problems that really came to the fore in the 90s.
Well, we talked in the 1970s about interdependence, and which was the notion of strong relationships between societies which made them dependent on each other. And it might be symmetrical, as in the case of Germany and France, or it might be asymmetrical, as in the case of the United States and Guatemala. And there are power dimensions of interdependence. And then we tried to analyze that. But the notion of interdependence was essentially conceived of as in trade. When goods are produced in two different countries, the U.S. and Japan, for example, and they trade them back and forth. And then we started talking about internationalization, and the phrase became globalization. And I think John Ruggie has the best analogy. John wrote me once that the difference between interdependence and globalization is the difference between national post offices and Federal Express. Mm-hmm. Federal Express takes everything to Memphis every night and redistributes it. So it doesn't matter where it comes from. The cost is the same. And globalization is a really increasing of the thickening of interdependence, the globalization of patterns, not just regionally but worldwide, and the shrinking of distance. Essentially, it's the process by which distance is shrunk, so that it's easier to have an effect in a faraway place than it was. And in my view, globalization is not merely be seen as economic, as it often is seen. It's social. It's ecological, and it's political military. So 9/11 is an example of globalization. The fact that a small number of people armed with box cutters can destroy the largest building in the biggest, most important city of the United States, that's a form of globalization. That is, they launched that plot in Afghanistan and Germany and elsewhere, and were able to take action at a distance. So it's not just economic globalization. It's economic, social, ecological. Global warming is a good example of globalization, and political military.
You mentioned 9/11, and that event, in addition to being a trauma for the United States coming out of the blue, at least in terms of public consciousness, but it also did it shatter some of our notions about where the international community was going, where international organizations were going. I'm talking both about the event and the U.S. response.
Well, it certainly has. It's changed the pattern a lot. I did an essay right after 9/11 on what I call the globalization of fear. And I drew an analogy between the globalization of formal violence in the period after World War II and the globalization of informal violence after 9/11. That is, or in 9/11, informal violence being violence by non-state actors who don't necessarily have a huge amount of force at their disposal, and who are not undertaking it in any formal way. So formal violence became globalized with the transcontinental bomber, nuclear weapons, and missiles. So that in 1944, Walter Lippmann said that now we the United States face the problem that we have to worry about who controls Europe and Japan as never before, because they can attack us. And they didn't used to be able to attack us. So the oceans, he said, used to be in effect a barrier, and now they're a way in which they can carry force across. And the United States strategy changed dramatically with nuclear weapons, because the United States had to follow a deterrent strategy, a forward strategy, couldn't simply sit back and say, the oceans protect us, we have plenty of time. If somebody gets really dangerous, like the Germans did under Hitler, we can then rearm and deal with it. The globalization of informal violence, and which 9/11 represents, was, I thought then, I think this part of my analysis was true, would lead to a fundamental change in U.S. strategy, because no longer could we wait and simply say we are going to sit back and not worry about this very much because we're protected. Because now we saw the jet aircraft could cross the ocean with these terrorists coming into the U.S. and then getting on planes. And, of course, they could also get on planes in Frankfurt directly and try to attack the United States. So there's this whole sense of the globalization of informal violence. And I used my mentor's discussion of the liberalism of fear to say that for much of history, liberals have been noted not for belief in progress, but for the fact that they fear government, coercive government violence. And now we would have to, as liberals, be worried about coercive non-governmental violence.
Are you surprised by the way the Bush administration has tipped the balance in some ways against international organizations and toward a unilateral response?
Well, I'm not surprised, because they came into office very much talking against international organizations, although in a different form. It was the old classic realist form. We've been giving up too much autonomy to international organizations. Condi Rice saying we shouldn't have 101st Airborne escorting kids to kindergarten in Bosnia. So it was very disdainful of some of the humanitarian missions and some of the other activities of international organizations. So I'm not surprised by it. It's very disappointing from a professional point of view, because when you think, as I do, that those of us who emphasize the role of institutions in world politics and their value, when we think we won the debate, which I think we did intellectually in the academy, it's disappointing to see these throwbacks. People, some of them old, like Rumsfeld, some of them not so old, like Rice, who just don't get it still. And that's one hopes, as an academic, that you'll teach people that over a period of 20 years, at least, they will learn some of these newer truths. So that's disappointing. Now, what the Bush administration did, I would differentiate three phases of the Bush administration since 9/11. The first is the Afghanistan phase, when they acted exactly as I think any great power would have acted. They, in fact, had the authority from the United Nations against Afghanistan, but would have acted anyway. It was a clear case of self-defense, and a case where efficacious action required a destruction of the bases for terrorism. Even though that wouldn't be a sufficient response, it was clearly a necessary response. And almost every state in the world recognized that, and almost everybody in the U.S. recognized that. So that's the first phase, which was entirely consistent with what I think any U.S. administration would have done. The second phase was their distinctive blend of realism plus, especially, it wasn't realism mostly, it was this neoconservatism, the belief they could change the whole world for the better by attacking Iraq. And it's clear that wasn't linked to Afghanistan. Even they didn't believe that. The weapons of mass destruction story was overblown dramatically, if not concocted. The realists actually were opposed to this war, because they said there are no the weapons of mass destruction are not such a big problem. Lots of countries have them. We can deter Iraq. Why are you invading it? They were invading it, I think it was, and I said this before the war, that it was like Thucydides' discussion of the Peloponnesian War. The real cause was the one kept most out of sight. Mm-hmm. And that was the real cause, I believe, was to demonstrate American power in the Middle East, to intimidate the Palestinians and to intimidate the Iranians, the Libyans, the Syrians, everybody else. And then I think that was the kind of hardline offensive realist purpose, Rumsfeld and Cheney. And then some people like Wolfowitz probably thought they were going to institute democracy in Iraq, and it's going to be easy. An easy process. So for all of this, they said those are much more important. If we can get the UN on board for our mission, fine, but we're not going to let the coalition determine the mission, in Rumsfeld's words, and so we're going to disdain the UN if it won't go along, which it wouldn't. Not only would the UN not go along, no more than four Security Council members would have voted for the U.S. Resolution in the end. Then we see a third phase, and the third phase becomes evident by about September, October of last year, when the U.S. starts realizing that the mess in Iraq is so bad and the U.S. so much lacks legitimacy that it can't solve the problem in Iraq. It can't get a moderately democratic, at least minimally democratic, stable government that has no civil war and no base for terrorism and a regime which is not totally opposed to the United States. Those goals can't be attained without the UN. And so you have Paul Bremer, like Frederick or Henry IV at Canossa, standing in the snow for 3 days. Bremer didn't stand in the snow, but he went to Kofi Annan's headquarters and begged Annan to come and do the report on the elections. Very, very much the same thing. Okay, we were wrong. They'll never say they're wrong. They haven't admitted being wrong on anything. But they have to, in effect, admit that they have to go back to the United Nations. So the overall story, I think, is, although it has more bumps in the road than I expected, is a story which shows the importance of international institutions. Because you have the test of that doesn't come when a regime is in power of people like me who are in favor of international institutions. The test comes when people are in power who are opposed to them instinctively. Mm-hmm. When they have to go back to them, then that tells you something. Now, I had a little bit wrong on the piece on 9/11. I thought that coming back to the UN right away after 9/11 would show that, and I didn't anticipate they would then so pigheadedly, I think, reject the United Nations and attack Iraq. But the overall story comes through in the same way, because once they attacked Iraq, they discovered that they needed international institutions, because the problem is you can't mobilize a long-standing coalition which is legitimate, of democratic countries whose publics care about legitimacy, unless you are aligned in some way with an international institution, the UN or something else, which is seen as representing the views of not just ourselves. And that's the overall lesson of Iraq, and that therefore sustains the view that international institutions are terribly important, even in this high politics security area, which is certainly interstate relations, the war in Iraq.
In that essay that you wrote at shortly after 9/11, you also applied some of the concepts you had developed to the problem of terrorism, talking about the asymmetry of information that the terrorists had. Talk a little about that insight, and what does it tell us about the future in terms of how we should deal with terrorism?
Okay, let me go back a step, because one of the problems with work on interdependence in the 1970s was that it often ignored power. And it sort of assumed that everything was going to be harmonious, we're all in the same boat, and the rhetoric of policymakers, even Henry Kissinger, was like that. But of course, the reality is that there are powerful and there are weak states, and powerful and weak other actors like multinational corporations or NGOs. And we developed, that is, Joe Nye and I developed a notion of asymmetrical interdependence. That is, the conception was that asymmetrical interdependence generates power relationships. So the more asymmetry you have in your favor, the stronger you are, or the better more you have of some resource, the more your advantage in influencing the outcome of an event. So if we go to 9/11, the asymmetries of resources run hugely in favor of the United States and its allies, and hugely against the terrorists. Al-Qaeda and the rest of them. But asymmetries of information before 9/11 rested heavily in favor of Al-Qaeda, because they understood the U.S. vulnerabilities. They understood that they were at war with the United States. The U.S. didn't understand that we were at war with them, and we weren't tracking them very well. So they had a temporary advantage, and they exploited it. Now, that advantage was temporary, because now they no longer, I think, have asymmetric information working on their behalf, given the high-tech capabilities of the U.S. especially. Mm-hmm. But I think the larger lesson, I think, in dealing with terrorism goes more to the Iraq-UN experience than to the informational point. That is, I think a larger lesson is that you need to be following policies which make you seem legitimate in the eyes of large numbers of people. Mao said about guerrillas that the fish swim in the sea. That is, the militants only survive if they have a lot of supporters of ordinary peasants. I think terrorists only survive if they have a lot of supporters in the population. Some people may actually feed them and support them and give them safe houses. Others will just not report, will just not oppose them. And if our policies are seen as reckless and arrogant and as oppressive to people in Pakistan or Indonesia, then they're not going to mobilize against terrorism, and they're going to maybe be a breeding ground for terrorists, or at least they're going to harbor them. So we have to worry about what Joe Nye calls our soft power, our ability to persuade people that essentially their lives will be better if they cooperate with us. And that's not going to be done on the barrel of a gun.
One final question. How would you advise students who are interested in either international politics or international relations theory? How should they be preparing for the future?
They should get a combination of two kinds of knowledge. And they seem antithetical, and in the academy they're sometimes at war with each other, but the students should not let that struggle hinder them. They should get interpretive knowledge. They should understand they should take courses on world politics, on history, on literature, which allow them to have an interpretive sense of the human condition in ways that are not encompassed by analytical techniques. So they're not the prisoners of some narrow technology. They also ought to get technological competence in economics, in math, in statistics, so they can do analysis when the topic is such that you can address it in a quantitative, hard scientific way. They should be able to do it. But they should also have the context, because nothing is more dangerous than addressing a problem in a hard science way without an understanding of the context, of the concepts that are involved. It's bound to be misleading and even dangerous.
Bob, on that note, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you, Harry. I enjoyed it very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.